Mini episode 102 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Royalty Tours USA, your ultimate resource to traveling in style to attend sporting events. Follow them on the web at royaltytours.blogspot.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
All right, folks, back with you again. Rick Morris, Kyle Ross. It's part seven of the Kyle Ross nine-part history of WrestleMania anthology here in the FDH Lounge.
With Rick Morris, by the way, of course.
Yeah, Rick Morris,
okay,
Kyle Ross.
I know when you put my name on the marquee, it sells out, but I mean, come on, Ricky, you're part of here.
Well, the name on the marquee also says wrestling, as the Briscoe brothers once said.
Yes.
But, and it's a good thing that it is named after you. I might be counting on you to carry the action here today. For anybody that can hear this now, allergies have robbed me of my, I won't say stellar pipes, but average pipes. So I know I sound like dog crap in this thing, but I am playing, not exactly playing hurt today. I don't feel that bad, but this is just my allergies.
You look well.
I'm actually not that bad. I got some rest yesterday. It's all good, fortunately.
You were in Austin, by the way, all last week.
Austin all last week, yes.
A fine city.
Yeah, it was
tremendous.
Shout
out to my good friend Chad Repack, who lives in the shadows of Austin, Texas.
Oh, what a...
And I know we'll be listening to this.
What a wonderful place, yeah. Yeah, love Austin, Texas, down there for South by Southwest Interactive. It was tremendous. And it was immediately after coming back on it from the trip that I pretty much lost my voice here. And again, allergies being what they are, you know, with this kind of weather we're getting here in northeastern Ohio from where we're based, unseasonably warm. But the fluctuation in temperatures is doing us a good thing. We are only recording this one here today as opposed to another two chapters. This one's a standalone here. Part seven of this
year. It's a big one, though.
Yes, it is a big one. It is the birth and death, I think you titled this, of the Attitude Era, WrestleManias 14 to 18.
Yes, so we're going to cover five WrestleManias in here. And I know that there's some people who are like, wow, you devoted a lot of time to, you know, just one or two WrestleManias, you know, sometimes three per podcast previously with the first six. And why are you doing so many now in one? You know, obviously the knee-jerk reaction would be say, oh, well, we've fallen behind and need to catch up. But it's not that at all.
You planned it this way.
Yeah,
you laid it out.
This was laid out this way. That the overall mentality of the promotion was pretty similar through a lot of these WrestleManias, so there's a lot of commonalities,
right,
that we can just kind of hit on in one. And that's in 14 through 18, like I said, the birth and death of Attitude. It's 18 is kind of like, yeah, you know, I didn't know whether to include it or not, mm-hmm, in this one, but considering the way I wanted to approach 19 through 21, mm-hmm, which we'll hit next, the three of them together, it made sense. It made sense.
Well, and it's one of those things where this is, we're going to be setting up the macro heading into the first one here for 14, but there's not as much we have to set up for the macro from year to year, because with this one, we're coming out of a period of extreme inconsistency, because in the past it had been, okay, two new guys on top, we'll try this, now we'll try this, now we'll try this. We're going into an era with a unified theme, and there really hadn't been a unified theme to a certain era since the boom period of the 80s.
Very true. But even the difference between, say, WrestleMania's 15 and 18 in terms of who's on top is a lot different than even, say, the first boom period that you look at. Sure, you had your consistencies of Hogan and Savage, mm-hmm, but other than those two, there really was a lot more turnover year to year in the promotion than you'll see in this period.
Right.
Which allows us to cover, I think, a few more than we could in previous podcasts.
Exactly. When we left this last, with the WrestleMania 13 one, we were heading out of the Bret Austin match that would come to set up really the start of the Attitude Era with the taking off of Stone Cold Steve Austin as the franchise.
Yes, and from that point on, and it's funny, I think I referenced this in the last podcast, you know, Mick Foley talked about how throughout 1997, those in the WWE locker room, although the ratings did not bear this out at the time, were of the opinion that they had the better show. And
yeah,
in retrospect, he's absolutely correct. you know, it was kind of at the time, though, I remember watching, you know, and it was so good to be a wrestling fan. I mean, the Monday Night Wars really picked up. And it did seem pretty even, I thought, throughout 99. Now, WCW had far more depth.
Right.
But it was very obvious that outside of the NWO, the WWE had the WWF at the time had the much hotter acts. Austin, you know, the Hart Foundation did the massive heel turn. You know, you had the beginnings, and this was kind of toward the end of the summer and into the fall. The Rock, you know, Rocky Maivia becoming The Rock and really nailing down his heel shtick. You know, DX was born in the fall of 1997. Michaels doing his massive heel turn post-SummerSlam and, you know, bringing along Buddy Triple H, who was kind of mired in the mid-card. You know, mm-hmm. He's considered mid-card for life, was always the joke with Triple H at the time, and that's a lot funnier, obviously, right now. you know, and he kind of ditched the snobby persona and just pal around with Shawn Michaels.
I always thought that was kind of jarring. The thing with Triple H was when he would change personas, they never would really explain it that much. And then the old kayfabe kid in me needs to understand.
I remember just being like, remember, he always came out, you know, and did a little curtsy and stuff like that. And then one week he just started coming out in polo shirt and jeans. I'm like, that's fine with me. You know, that's fine with
me. Shouldn't have been okay. At the very least, I was affecting this previous thing and I'm done with it now. I guess that's implied by what happened, but
yeah,
still, I thought it was sloppy. Dot the I's and cross the T's, please.
I'll say this.
Yeah.
I bought him far more as Shawn Michaels' less talented buddy than as an aristocrat, so it worked for me, okay? Because I thought he played that role a lot better, so.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. There's no question.
But the bottom line is, I remember, and, you know, obviously the big thing in the fall of 97 is as we get to WrestleMania 14, the big thing was obviously the Montreal Screwjob with Bret Hart. And at that point, you know, we talked about just a moment ago, you know, those in the locker room, and Mick Foley, obviously, was a big part of what they were doing in 97, obviously, that there was the mentality that the WWE was putting on the better show. And certainly there are great Raw, I think it was in May of 97, where Austin hijacked the ambulance with Bret Hart.
Right.
Jumped, you know, that one, obviously, you know, people remember that one. But despite that, the ratings did not bear out the fact that WWE was the better show at all.
Right.
As a matter of fact, by the end of 97, they were in a lot of trouble when the Bret Hart thing came to fruition because it was very clear he was going to WCW. WCW was ahead in the ratings. They were building to what should have been, and this is a different podcast for a different day, where don't let me go down this road, what should have been their WrestleMania 3, Starrcade 97.
Right.
Said it was a disgrace. One of the worst pay-per-views I've ever seen. Again, a different podcast for a different day. Oh, by the way, who's to blame for that? Just keep that in mind when I start ripping on a you-know-who later on in this podcast.
We'll get there. We'll talk about that with 18.
Okay.
Yeah.
And on paper, when you're going to lose your top guy, Bret Hart was the champion. He won it at SummerSlam to justify the big heel turn, and it was deservingly so, his fifth reign. It looked over, man, for the WWE. I mean, unless you were a real diehard, and because Austin was hurt at this time, too. On paper, it looked like nothing short of disaster, the WWF. And lo and behold, it not only was it not disaster, now there are a lot of, again, don't have enough time to go into all these things. You know, WCW's complete mishandling of Bret Hart coming into their promotion, a big thing. But even if they had handled it well, I don't know if that mattered. Because Austin does come back. You know, they found ways to involve him in the show. The biggest one was when he stunned McMahon for the first time in MSG, September of 97. And although he wasn't wrestling, he was still really, really over. It was a serious neck injury he suffered against Owen Hart, but it was clear he was going to be fine again. It was clear that he was going to be able to work WrestleMania. It was pretty obvious probably by the end of December that he was going to win the Royal Rumble, go on not only and challenge Shawn Michaels, but beat Shawn Michaels in the main event at WrestleMania. And he was the man. I mean, it started, like you said, where we last left off with the WrestleMania 13 podcast. It was just, you really can't quantify just how much better he was than everyone else in the business at that point.
Yeah, he was.
As a draw.
He was. And in retrospect, again, and that's part of it too, you can look at it that addition by subtraction, Hart and Michaels were out of the way. Michaels because of the back injury he would suffer at Royal Rumble 98. Hart because of going to the WCW promotion. You could look at it that way. Again, maybe they just kind of got lucky there. But I look at it, and maybe it's a little bit of revisionist thinking. I'm not going to say if Bret Hart took the title, it would have been no big deal. But it's a thing where they still had Austin, and that was all they needed. That was really all they needed going forward here. I think at the time we got a little bit too much caught up in the other major players there. But Austin was going to be the big player the next couple of years, and maybe that should have been a little bit more apparent even when Montreal went down.
Yeah, but again, at the time, to be fair, and it maybe is a little revisionist because you didn't know he was hurt. Is he going to? I mean,
that's true. His neck.
He wrestled at Survivor Series. It was a real weak match against Owen Hart. But you know, the following month wrestled Rock, who obviously becomes the other big player in this situation, more so down the road than late '97. They did kind of a garbagey brawl, but he was fine. But you didn't know really until kind of WrestleMania rolled around. I remember watching. I was like, oh my. You know, here's my point. At the end of 1997, to say Stone Cold Steve Austin could become a bigger draw than Hulk Hogan was in his big period would have been a highly questionable statement. About 6 months later, it was very obvious that he was going to be.
Yeah.
And he was. The numbers bear that out. Any of these people who say, oh, Hogan, this, Hogan, look, the man drew some amazing crowds. He was the linchpin of the first boom era. You know, if you took his name off the card, that said card would suffer.
Right.
But Austin was drawing. I mean, they were doing record business in every building they were in throughout 1998 for weekly Monday Night Raws.
Right.
I mean, they set records almost weekly
they
were drawing, which is just unbelievable. So,
well, for the final piece of macro before we get to WrestleMania 14, because we're setting it up pretty well here. We're doing a very good job, if I do say so myself. Too bad the camera doesn't catch me patting myself on the back here. But your theory about something Gary Hart once said, and about
Gary Hart's theory. It's just me regurgitating it.
Yeah, but how that ties into this.
Gary Hart, and I believe this was on, as a matter of fact, I'm positive it was on, because it's the only thing he would commentate on that I would have watched in the last 5 years. One of the world-class TVs. It's probably the independently produced one, not the WWE-produced one, because of the WWE would, of course, edited a comment like this off. Okay,
right.
But he made the comment, and he was talking about the promotion he was booking for, world-class, down in Texas in the early 80s, that if you're looking to take off, if you're looking to really make a big impact, you need to start over with all new guys. Now, Gary Hart was handed a very easy plate to work with when he was given the Von Erich boys.
Yeah, he had old guys that weren't over, and he had the Von Erichs and the Freebirds coming in.
Yeah, and so basically, and it was a little different where, certainly you didn't need to worry about the depth. You didn't need world class in 1982, did not need the manpower on a roster that, say, the WWE needs today.
Top heavy promotion. It was always about two or three cards on the show, or the matches on the card.
Yes, but when I think about Gary Hart saying, you got to start fresh, you got to go with all new guys because they're all hungry, they're all pushing each other, there's no politics, I always think about this period building up to WrestleMania 14, how if you look at the card, it was all guys who were relatively, not necessarily new, but fresh in their roles. I mean, some guys had been around for a while, others had not, but they were all guys that had a chip on their shoulder. You know, I wasn't in the locker room at the time, never have been. I got to imagine the feeling was pretty good in that locker room, the mentality. It was kind of a real team as opposed to, you know, most wrestling locker rooms where it's anything but, certainly compared to WCW at that same time period.
Right.
I think it was a more unified locker room. But I just think of that in that the Bret Hart getting, quote-unquote, screwed and Shawn Michaels getting injured at the Rumble did work to their benefit. It's kind of the opposite now where they're given things that seem like a slam dunk and they kind of screw it up.
Right.
Back then, it seemed like they were dealt hands like, oh, no, this is bad.
Right.
And not only would it not be bad, it would somehow work itself out. Because it had Bret and Shawn kind of still been around, first of all, their relationship had grown so toxic it would have torn apart the locker room.
Right.
But it would have weighed the cards down because you would have always had to find a way throughout 1998 to put Bret in a match near the top, put Shawn in a match. And it would have just, while they're two incredible workers, two of the top five best in-ring guys of all time, maybe top two, top three, along with Ric Flair, it wouldn't have been good for the overall mentality of the promotion because they were going attitude. It was a new era,
right.
And those guys were associated with kind of the, rightly or wrongly, with the down period. And so, although it makes no sense on paper, it worked to their benefit that both Bret Hart was gotten rid of at Survivor Series 97, and then Shawn Michaels wrestles for the final time for 4.5 years at this show, WrestleMania 14.
I agree, and basically, again, it shows that Vince can only really spin gold when his back's against the wall and all the odds are against him. If you hand him a bunch of stuff on a silver platter, he'll underachieve like hell. But if his back's to the wall, he'll make something with nothing.
I've always thought about this. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to give Vince credit for this because his back was against the wall and he probably had to. Jim Ross and Jim Cornette were two of his point men
right.
at this period. Okay, mm-hmm. A lot better than some of the you know, shpabools he's got as his point men these days. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, they were guys who were not of his mentality
right.
in this business.
Right.
You know, Jim Ross, when he was in charge of talent relations,
yeah.
wasn't looking in beauty magazines. Okay,
yeah, that's true.
He hires a Steve Austin, a Mick Foley, a Brian Pillman, guys who had – it was non-Vince people, non-conventional
right.
WWE guys. So yeah, you'll see that this is probably one of the most unlikely WrestleManias to succeed, WrestleMania 14.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the best ever. It's a top four WrestleMania for me, beating
right.
shows that have probably a lot better wrestling on them and a lot better star power. But when you watch WrestleMania 14, kids, okay, you're going to be like,
it's
wow.
Fun.
You're like, this was a fun WrestleMania, and I can't wait to see where – now, obviously, in retrospect, we all know where they went.
Right.
But I remember watching this time, it's like, God, I can't wait for Raw tomorrow night. And I remember that Raw the night after the show was one of the best Raws they ever did. Where
it
Triple
was.
H assumed power of DX.
It was.
You know, the Austin McMahon feud, really. McMahon established himself as the top heel in the promotion. It was just a great period. And whereas you could see the WWE coming back after WrestleMania 13 because of Austin's performance in the match with Bret Hart, you could see very clearly after the show that they were going to overtake WCW. In the ratings.
Yeah, they were going in that direction. Last thing I'm going to say, a macro note before we set this up, just a little bit of a counterpoint to Gary Hart's point. I agree, but if you don't have the right ingredients, nothing matters, because my first counterpoint thought would be, like, say, AWA 1987.
Oh.
That was a new crew.
Okay, yeah.
And
well,
they sucked.
Yeah, well, it was a new crew out of necessity,
right.
Not a new crew out of scouting. You know what I'm saying?
Right,
I mean,
right.
It was a little different where...
Theoretically, in a big promotion, you can always go get guys you want rather than getting stuck with guys like the AWA did in 87.
Yeah, they were being stuck. It's not like they were going out and finding those
right.
guys. It was like, okay,
right.
we just lost all of our top guys, and we
right.
just need to have... You know, we have these cards, and someone's got to be on top of
right.
them. You know, whereas, you know, in the case of Gary Hart, he was... Again, handed on a silver platter.
Right.
The owner of the company's like, here are my sons. They're going to be the featured baby faces in this company.
Right.
Well, they're new, and it worked very well for a couple years.
And the Freebirds had already gotten themselves over in Georgia Championship Wrestling
yes.
to various extent. I'm not downplaying what Gary Hart did. Still great booking, but you also got to have the ingredients. WrestleMania 14.
They had the new talent and the ingredients here.
Yeah, exactly.
For this WrestleMania.
And this WrestleMania, yeah, this was the changing of the guard, moving out of the period of uncertainty of the previous couple of WrestleManias when it would be different from year to year. Last note that I have, and this is something I came across late in the game when I was preparing to do this with you here. I was looking back through. I had subscribed from late 97 to late 99 to The Torch, and I still have those at home. So I was flipping through looking at them. It's interesting that as far back as January of 98, because of the whole angle with Mike Tyson and everything set
and
up
we
with
should
him,
definitely talk about
we'll talk
that
about
here.
That. But Wade Keller was saying... January of 98, and I applaud him for this because I sure wouldn't have thought this at that time.
I don't applaud Wade Keller very often.
I don't either, and I'm a big fan of certain proclivities of his, but be that as it may, I got to give it to him for this because I think you're picking up what I'm putting down there.
Thank you, Tim Hardaway.
Yeah, thank you. But I give him so much credit because in January of 98, he said in The Torch, this is shaping up to be the biggest WrestleMania in a decade. Now, look, he's wrong on that one. You'd have to go back to maybe WrestleMania 8. That was still pretty big.
Oh, I think this was bigger than 8.
Of 98 to say that, that's remarkable that he called it 2 months
out. It was,
out.
And I just read something that Meltzer had written that he knew the Tyson deal would be big.
Right.
But no one saw... you know, the near 800,000 buys this show, right. night, which was huge. When you consider, and keep in mind, that's 800,000 domestic kids. Okay,
right.
That's not like now where they factor in international.
Right.
They
How many guys in a hut in Guam were watching?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, we'll count those as 17 buys. No. The previous WrestleMania domestically did like 275-ish.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a huge increase from year to year. WrestleMania 13 is the least bought WrestleMania of
right.
all time. And for that to jump, obviously, you know, it was two things. It was the involvement of Tyson, who was still a major, major marketing. His star had begun to fade in boxing.
Right.
But it's kind of a novelty act and a name.
Still a huge pop culture guy.
He still meant a lot. And then, you know, obviously the rising star, Austin. You put those two elements together, and it was just unbelievable. Obviously, in January of 98, they did the big angle on Raw where they were going to announce Tyson's involvement in WrestleMania. They do the thing where Austin comes out and calls him out. That mm-hmm. was huge. That made Austin look like such
yep.
a star
yep.
when he came out and was like, because it's sort of ridiculous to like have Steve Austin come out. Oh yeah, Mike Tyson, I can beat your ass.
Right.
Like come on.
Right.
But what was crazy? It didn't matter that is ridiculous because people bought it.
Yeah.
People were like, yeah, can, yeah, do it. And it's just like, you know.
CNN was all over it, and they had a sister company that was a big wrestling promotion.
Yeah, and then, yeah, exactly. And, you know, it was on made ESPN.
Sports Center moment, yeah.
This was felt a lot cooler than, like, the desperation of LT that we spoke of in the last podcast.
Right.
You know, Tyson, again, like an LT, was past that.
They
athletic
found
pride,
a way to make it work.
He still. And then I was there, of course. I don't know if you were.
At
that
not.
Famous Cleveland Raw, March of 98.
I was not.
Oh,
yeah,
you
but
were?
That, I was not.
Where Tyson, I remember that was such a good angle where Michaels called him out for face-to-face. They were acting like they were going to do the same thing that he did with Tyson did with Austin, and he rips the shirt off. Tyson's got the DX shirt on underneath. You know, Jim Ross with that great line. Mm-hmm. You know, this was exactly the Sports Center moment I was looking for. But and so it sets it up with Tyson because Tyson was getting a negative reaction.
Right.
That was kind of when that element of the crowd, you know, previous crowds were always very complimentary, respectful towards celebrities.
Right.
The crowd had changed. A WWE crowd had changed dramatically in 1997.
Right.
They began to incorporate elements of it wasn't, obviously it was nowhere near approaching like the smartness of an ECW crowd.
Right.
But, you know, it was always like these kind of like, I remember the signs were like, I always used to love like checking out the signs when they started in the 90s. It was so much different that like everyone brought a sign. You know, they were funny. It wasn't like Cena rules with a Z. It was, you know, Triple H mid-card for life. You know, I remember like one like guy in Canada the one time, he had seven guys, you know, holding up a each letter. It said HBK equals fag. Okay? I mean, you talk about something that they wouldn't show today.
Well, you know, I brought one the one time, and I had in a lot of ones had the down arrows. I had the one with the down arrow that I would hold up over the guy in front of me that said Pat Patterson's boy toy.
So, okay, there you go. You know, I'd rather be in China. That was always
a that was one. Or with the down arrow, Joey Tribbiani's hand twin.
So
we would do ones like that.
Yeah, or I always love the ones, too, where it would just be some random guy, like, you know, Steve Jones sucks. You know, those were always good. So it was all the elements were there. It was a different crowd. You just felt it was just really fun going into the show. And this is the Boston crowd, okay? I know that in certain parts of this town here in Cleveland, Ohio, we hate Boston, okay? You know, they get too much Sports Center coverage.
I'm one of those parts.
Yeah, I know you are. Okay, well, give a big thumbs up. And by the way, this is one of... Well, it's not the one. I guess it is one of the last non-stadium WrestleManias, I guess. And for all the people who talk about the pluses of the arena over a stadium show, which is the number one is the crowd just more intimate. It feels like a hotter crowd. Definitely, definitely Exhibit A is this show right here. A molten hot crowd in Boston that night.
Red hot crowd. And, again, they made the most of it with the Tyson angle. Looking at the undercard, there were a couple of notable things here. In the opening match, LOD 2000, as they make their way to the ring, winning a 15 tag team battle royal. I'm looking down the list of luminaries, the New Midnight Express, the old Rock and Roll Express, the Truth Commission. Boy, it shows you we weren't much into the era, aside from Tyson, of celebrities at WrestleMania, because I would have thought Nelson Mandela would have come to the ring with the Truth Commission.
Well, they had,
here's my geopolitical
they had the, yes,
joke
they had
of the night.
Jackal, instead. Don Callis. this was a total throwaway. It was not exactly a very well-kept secret
right.
that the LOD, who had done this split angle, they had gotten into a fight. It was supposed to be, we're going to come back and kind of be rechristened. They were going to
put out there with Sonny.
Yeah, Sonny was involved, but another, and it's kind of funny that Sonny was put with her because this was kind of, it made sense because the LOD always carried, yeah. you know, they're the LOD, man. You know
right.
what I'm saying? I mean, they were always, you know, a big name no matter what they were doing. But it's kind of funny that of all the things they tried on paper again,
right.
this looks like a no-brainer. Okay, Sonny, a big name from the last couple of years, hot. LOD, famous team. Okay, let's put them together. LOD's obviously going to go on to win the tag team titles. It was not a well-kept secret that this whole stupid battle royal mm-hmm. was just there to put them over. Puts them over, but they did not really go anywhere from there. They kind of
right.
quickly morphed in the OLD, as I like to call them,
yeah.
because they just weren't, they weren't new.
Right.
You know, the new, pardon the pun, the new age outlaws were, who we'll talk about.
The futuristic and, biker gear wasn't over. Insert the Sonny holding their helmets punchline here.
Yeah, and Hawk was, in all due respect, was not well. At
yeah.
this point, I mean, he was kind of off the
yeah,
rocker.
Yeah.
So this was, you know, of all the positive things we just talked about this period and this show, this battle royal was not one of them.
Right, right. They eliminated Bombastic Bob and Bodacious Bart. To win the Battle Royal.
Yeah.
Ironically enough, not Bart's worst WrestleMania moment. That'll come the next year.
Yeah, really.
Some throwaways here on the undercard. Takami Chinoku, a 5-minute, 57-second match. He defends the light heavyweight championship against Aguila.
Yeah, and well, that's Esa Rios with a mask.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't need to write a book to let people know that the one thing WCW always did much better than WWF was the cruiserweight/light heavyweight. Taka was, you know, they had started it probably, the division, just because WCW was having some
sure.
success with it.
He was over at the outset because he was great.
Well, he wasn't supposed to be the linchpin of the division. It was supposed to be Great Sasuke.
Yeah.
And Vince kind of thought Taka outshined him at the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view, so he's like, well, screw it. I'm going to make Taka my champion. They did
right.
kind of, not raid isn't the right term, but they did get some talent, some other talent from Michinoku Pro.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, the great Dick Togo and Kaientai came over
yep.
shortly. But look, it didn't matter.
Sweet ass senton.
Yeah, yes, yes. It didn't matter. This was, Taka was over, but look, this division by the end of the year was a joke.
Right. Two guys soon to be in a double turn, Triple H, defending the European Championship against Owen Hart. They did the angle with Sergeant Slaughter. Handcuffed to China at ringside. She gets out the powder. Boom, boom, bam. Triple H wins.
Look, there are a lot of people, my good friend Chad Repack being one of them,
mm-hmm.
That thought like Owen Hart got like such...
The Bob Sacramento of our show.
Yes, yes. Felt that Owen Hart got such mistreatment here by doing the job. I couldn't agree less. Owen Hart, look.
They already neutered him by this point. The momentum he had coming back
yeah,
as the angry badass loner was already
gone. And look,
gone.
He should not have beaten Shawn Michaels for the title. I know that
right.
from his character's perspective, it would have been nice.
Right.
But
yeah, they needed to save Michaels for Austin.
Austin, exactly.
Yeah.
And Triple H, again, he was what was new. You know, it was, you know, China did the low blow and stuff. You know,
right.
a lot of this was to put her over, too. And she was
right.
a big part of Triple H still during this period.
Right.
And the right guy won. This was for the, by the way, this is when the European title, people still cared about that.
Right.
So
during those 5 minutes.
Yes. But right guy goes over, Triple H the next night, you know, becomes the new leader of DX, which eventually a group that, you know, goes babyface.
Yep.
Yeah, by the way, a year previous, how ridiculous did babyface Triple H sound?
That's
how
true.
Ridiculous. Well, I guess, you know, now it's not
yeah.
so ridiculous, but that was, he was so much different during that period than he is, you know, previously or certainly now.
Yeah, he really was. But
and Owen, yeah, he gets, I mean, you know, I don't really want to
go
was, into that.
Yeah, I mean, and they did the right thing turning him heel because he was lost in the shuffle as a
yeah,
face.
Yeah, I mean, the Nation,
point.
It was kind of silly.
Yeah,
and
being,
by kind
being the
of,
white
I mean,
guy in the Nation.
Really silly.
Yeah.
But with The Rock, you know, The Rock, politically, he never liked kind of like the black separatist
right.
Element of the Nation he's always talked about. So I think they just did that. It was just a heel group that he was.
Right.
I mean, look, Owen Hart never really fit into that, but, I mean, you would know, the Nugget thing, it was always kind of over.
It was the Attitude Era. You would have thought they would have busted out an Al Jolson gimmick for him or something,
there,
but
yes.
That would have fit in. Mark Mero and Sable defeated the artist formerly known as Goldust and Luna in a mixed tag team match in 9 minutes and 11 seconds.
When I use the term or phrase, whichever you may be,
mm-hmm.
a match that was better than it ever had any right to be.
Right.
This match probably pictured in the encyclopedia.
But Merrill, Rhodes, and Luna all above average workers.
Yeah, but that's not what mattered. Right. It mattered a little bit. The bottom line, Sable was probably the number two star on this show.
And it's amazing.
People forget that
because
her star fell so quickly.
Right.
After this. But she was so big there, and she tried really hard during this, and the crowd was so... I mean, she was doing, like, at the time, like, now it's not that big of a deal, but, like, to see someone kind of doing, like, men's, like, a chick who... She had never really wrestled before this.
Right.
I don't think she'd ever wrestled. Going out and doing men's finishing moves.
Right.
Like, she did the power bomb and stuff like that. Like, people, like, came... I remember I was watching the big group. The place just came unglued. She did the TKO, Mero's move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was... Goldust, who was so shameless during this period, was really selling for... This was better than it had any right to be. This is, like, a 3.5-star match. I mean, this is just, like,
right.
one of those things that's like, oh, God, just, like, come on, get through it. Let's get to the... This was very enjoyable, and again, the new at Sable, you know, Mero, it's kind of funny, after this, he was kind of just useless, you know. He was kind of a funny, you know, misogynistic heel for a little bit after this, but, you know, Sable was clearly the star, and she was put over accordingly here.
She was, yeah. The Rock defending the Intercontinental title against Ken Shamrock by disqualification at only 4:49. That was a short one. They did the gimmick where Shamrock beat him but wouldn't let go of the thing, and I think what they reversed it by.
Yeah, they reversed the decision because he kept like he refused to let go of the ankle lock.
And The Rock had already done the interview earlier in the show with Jennifer Flowers, which was hilarious. He's getting his catchphrases out. The people I was watching this with were really really laughing their asses off, and it was one of those things I said to you off air. This show was the beginning of where you could see, boy, they're going to have to turn him at some point. When they do, he's going to be pretty hot.
Yeah, you didn't. I mean, he certainly was. You wouldn't have predicted that he would have been the foil for Austin the next year. I don't think that. I'm trying to kind of remember where my mentality was with him at that time. I would not have guessed defending world heavyweight champion the next year at WrestleMania.
But by the same token, you couldn't hardly look at this crew and see anybody as a challenger for Austin.
No, it wasn't.
Keep in mind how much of a stretch it seemed like to put him in with Foley right after WrestleMania.
Yes, yes. You're absolutely right. And it just goes back to, hey, you got to start over. You got to go with new talent. And the match here is irrelevant because it worked well. I know that from a star rating snowflake standpoint, this is not a world-beating match.
Right.
But here's the key. It kept Shamrock looking strong. See, rather than matches that they do today where no one comes out looking good,
right.
Both guys came out. Shamrock looked strong. He was playing in the, like, kind of the insane, you know, fighter gimmick.
Yep.
And then I'll never forget, though, they reversed the decision, and The Rock is being, who got, like, no offense into the match, gets stretchered out, and they announce the decision's been reversed. Still Intercontinental Champion, The Rock. And they show him getting stretchered out, and he lifts the belt up like he just did something. You know, like he won. And it was such a great heel move, and I remember Jim Ross going, "The Irishman's been robbed in Boston." And then, you know, Shamrock goes crazy and beats him up again on the stretcher. And again, it was everyone was kind of like, you're right, this Rock's pretty entertaining. And, you know, the Shamrock's pretty badass. So, again, mission accomplished.
The SummerSlam 93 match wants its finish back. way to ape the Bret Hart, Jerry Lawler
thing. Yeah, but this was
guys.
Better. This was cooler.
This is everything that one
Although Jerry
been.
Lawler's story before that match was tremendous.
That was.
I believe how he saved the orphans from the burning bus.
Yeah, that was tremendous. 10 minutes and 1 second in a dumpster match for the WWF Tag Team title. The Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie defeated the New Age Outlaws. They would, refund the belts the next night. In a rematch here, Chainsaw Charlie, the moniker for this time period, for whatever reason, of Terry Funk.
I have no idea why they did that. Like, they referred to him as Terry Funk a lot on commentary. Like, Jim Ross kind of,
right.
like, just no-sold the whole gimmick. I think he just wasn't going to call him. I think he, like, half-heartedly did it at the beginning.
Right.
And then by this, like, I remember, like, they even called him, Road Dogg even called him Terry Funk. This is kind of interesting because... In some regards, it does go against the mentality we talk about the show, where it kind of went to the even though Cactus is never someone you associate with tradition, certainly at this time,
right.
he was a guy that really got his big breakout following the show, the heel turn that he did, you know, when he was the corporate suck-up Dude Love for Vince McMahon, which I enjoyed so much. But the New Age Outlaws, look, I know that, like, now it's everyone's like, oh, they stink, they were bad, you know, they're terrible. They were really hot, man, at this point. They were guys that, like, they had, like, and it was, again, one of those things that on paper seemed terrible, but worked out, like, here you had two total JTTS guys.
Right.
That had just been bad for a long time. You know, they tried doing the Rockabilly heel turn in 97, where he was the protege of the Honky Tonk Man. That was a colossal flop. You know, almost as bad as the real Jesse James, you know, for the Road Dogg. And then they just kind of came together one week. You're like, these two bums are going to form a team? Like, this is seems like somebody's not trying. Seems like the bottom of the Pat Patterson gimmick barrel. And it works. Like, they just had unbelievable chemistry.
In an insanely hot year for the company, I'd say they were probably the number three act behind Rock and Austin.
They and everyone
not in
says,
that order.
Yeah, everyone kind of selfishly. I'd put Sable ahead of them, too.
Okay.
But still, you know, everyone kind of accuses them of being, like, you know, kind of shamelessly putting themselves over when they claim they were the hotter part of the babyface version of DX.
They were.
I agree completely. Their catchphrase, I mean, you know, X-Pac had a lot of charisma, but, you know, in WWE land, he's really small, and he's not going to get a fair shake, probably.
Right.
You know, Triple H was certainly, during the babyface DX era, the guy with the least amount of charisma. He was the leader, but he was the least had the least amount of charisma. They really were the guys, you know, the people. And again, like, I think the guy on the internet now rolls his eyes about the New Age Outlaws and their catchment. People, I was in college shortly after this. I was a senior in high school when this WrestleMania happened, but I was college. People loved, like, doing that, you know, that shtick they did, you know, ladies and gentlemen, boys.
It was contagious.
Yeah, it was. People loved that, and they lose here as a dumpster. By the way, there was a great angle to set this up where they. Cactus and Funk were just wrestling randomly on a Raw.
Right.
They tackled each other in a dumpster. The Outlaws came out, shut the dumpster, and pushed it over the edge.
One of the only breakings of kayfabe that was, like, smoothly done that I think I've ever seen. It's usually ham-handed, but the way that everybody showed concern,
yes.
It was...
Sonny came out crying.
Textbook, yes. Textbook.
Yeah, Sonny did come out crying. I did love when Shawn Michaels and Triple H tried to hog the live on his segment. They came out and say, see, now you'll be made of betters. You know, that one, Shawn probably pilled out of his mind at that time, but
true.
That's okay. But, you know, they lose here just kind of because it kind of works out. The baby faces need to get revenge.
Right.
But then they did the immediate rematch the next night on Raw, the steel cage match, where the Outlaws win it back and... With the new DX, X-Pac debuts, obviously, the next night, comes into the promotion. He cuts a red-hot promo, burying Hogan and Bischoff.
That was glorious.
When you better not step short of Hulk, otherwise Eric Bischoff will go so far up your ass, you know, he'll know what you had for breakfast. And they weren't immediately baby faces, DX, you know. It was one of those things that it's like, wow, everyone's just cheering these guys, might as well make them a baby face.
Well, and then when they had Owen... turn and join the Nation.
Yeah.
That was like the emphasis of a double turn.
I loved the DX. By the way, as far as mid-card feuds go, the DX versus Nation feud of the summer 98, one of the all-time best.
It really, really was. The next one, 16 minutes, 58 seconds, kind of long for two guys like this, but I guess it worked okay. The Undertaker defeated Kane in the long-awaited first match between them.
Yeah, and notice long-awaited first match, okay? I don't think anyone's awaiting any more of these, but the first of about 10,002 that they've had. And this was kind of the one match that maybe didn't hit expectations, I thought, at the time. It seemed kind of boring. And I remember, now, the entrance was awesome. Obviously, the build-up to this was incredible, where they had Kane debut at Hell in a Cell the previous fall. By the way, some people think that takes away from that match. I couldn't disagree.
I kind of do.
I couldn't.
It didn't have a clean ending to it.
Yeah, but Shawn Michaels won. I thought the whole story of the match was they were putting him in this big cage, and the only way he could conceivably win is if the Undertaker's half-brother, who had been presumably dead for 20 years, just happened to show up at the arena that night and help him. And, it's wrestling, and guess what? That happens.
Personal prejudice on my part. It's just I don't know how a match can be 5 stars if a guy wins entirely due to an outside interference.
I give it the full Monty.
Okay.
I give it the full. I think that was not only not a bad ending, I thought it was the only possible ending you do.
Sure, sure. I'm just saying I think it puts a lower ceiling on the match than you do. But
I thought that was the only ending you could do. Because the obvious thing was Michaels had to win.
Right.
But how is he going to win? Like, he's not going to, what's he going to beat him clean with? Like, see, that was, they were still kind of in the period, too, where heels don't win clean.
Right.
And I'm kind of old school like that. I don't think heels should, because if a babyface loses clean, that doesn't look good. I think most fans kind of view him as a loser then.
Right.
I thought it was a great ending. But anyway, to this match, so Kane, he starts dot the Undertaker, you know, kind of similar to the Bret Owen thing. I would never fight my brother. And eventually, you know, Kane lights the casket on fire when the Undertaker loses the Royal Rumble match.
Right.
And the Undertaker comes, again, at that same Cleveland Raw that Tyson turned and joined DX. You know, the Undertaker returns, challenges him to a match. This didn't really live up to expectations. I remember being shocked that Kane kind of got his heat back afterwards, because Kane to me always seemed like kind of like a Nails character and always has, in the way that his character is so tied to another character that I always assumed going into this WrestleMania that Kane was kind of going to be like a one-and-done act. He would be beaten cleanly here, and he'd be gone. See, keep in mind, wrestling fans, that was 13 years ago, and this idiot's still in the promotion.
See, I've always been more of a Glenn Jacobs guy, not merely because he's a fan of Austrian economics, but no, I've always thought for a big man, he's an above-average worker.
That has nothing to do with it. But the character itself, when you look at a character, okay, first of all...
Wrestling's had a lot of madman characters. Are we going to dismiss them all and say that madman characters should be longstanding?
No, you're missing the point. It's not that he's a madman, it's not that he's above it. His character, preposterous as this storyline was, and people need to remember, before he debuted...
It's been retconned a million times.
Before that he had debuted the way he did, which, by the way, is another reason that I love that debut. When that storyline started with Paul Bearer's, like, you have a brother who you think is dead, but he's still alive.
Right.
You know, people were rolling their eyes like, this sounds hideous.
Right.
You know, and then he debuted, and people were like, oh, wow, they couldn't have done that any better. When you have a storyline, let's take a look at the storyline. As ridiculous as the storyline is, here's a guy who's been presumed dead for 20 years. Okay, hold the Undertaker's spot. What's he going to, like, have a six-month feud with the guy and then go on to other things? Like, I always thought that, like, he was so tied to the one character that was his shelf life.
No, see, I always thought that he would stick around because, and it's not 20/20 hindsight, because I saw him as a guy where they were just looking for the right thing to do with him, and he came in with such, as you said, phenomenal build. He came in with that because he had been Unabomber in Smoky Mountain Wrestling. He'd already been, fake Diesel previously.
Yeah, but most people didn't know that.
Isaac Yankum, but it was one of those things where I saw him as a guy where they saw him as somebody they wanted to do something big with, but they just hadn't figured it out. When he came in with such epic build, I didn't think he was a disposable character. I really didn't.
Well, he was really hot. So, but I'm just saying, like, if you look at the history of the company and the history of really the business, when you have a character who is specifically brought, you have to remember, he was specifically brought into feud with The Undertaker.
Right.
He was not a character, okay, this is his story, oh, he's feuding with The Undertaker.
Now,
it was a character that was devised, and it was a storyline basically for The Undertaker.
Right.
And I don't know when the decision was made. I don't know if it was before the storyline started. They liked Glenn Jacobs and wanted to put him in a storyline. Okay, we could do this. Or if they had a storyline, okay, we're going to bring back The Undertaker's presumed dead brother, Kane. Who should we have playing? Okay, how about this Glenn Jacobs guy? He's got some talent.
Okay.
I don't know what came first. But to me, when you look at the history, like, I remember thinking, it's like, okay, The Undertaker will beat Kane, and that's pretty much it for Kane.
I
never would have thought, going into that show, that 13 years later, Kane would still be in the promotion.
Wouldn't have thought that, no. The bridges, we're talking about this from the main event.
We'd be remiss if we didn't mention Pete Rose's phenomenal showing in this.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When he comes
out. Tombstone by Kane.
Well, yeah, but
it's, the shtick was awesome.
The shtick was incredible. He just comes out. And again, this goes back to, it was a different time period. You know, celebrities kind of came out and just, like, made some, you know, some token wrestling jokes. He comes out and just starts insulting the Boston crowd.
Right.
He's like, you know, he's like, I left tickets for Bill Buckner, but he bent over and couldn't pick them up. And, you know, he's like, yeah, we beat. And I think he even, like, comes out. And he's like, yeah, we played you guys in the World Series and we beat your ass.
Yeah.
And Jim Ross is like, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, and then he gets Tombstone again. He gets Tombstone by Kane to kind of give Kane some heat.
Yeah.
And you know, they would go, you know, pardon the pun, with some heat, but they'd have the Inferno match the next month, which was terrible, of course. But
it was.
It went to show afterwards that Kane was sticking around, and, you know, Undertaker does win the match, but it wasn't a maybe I'm just wrong. I just imagine going into this Undertaker, very clean win, goes on to something new.
Okay.
I was surprised. And I was wrong. Kane did deserve. Now, I'd like to just point out when I'm wrong. Kane did deserve to stay around.
Right.
Not for 13 years, but he did deserve to stay around for a little bit.
I would agree with that.
No one deserves to stay around for 13 years.
Not always near the top of the card as well. The Undertaker, the bridge from talking about this to the main event, he had wrestled Shawn Michaels, as you indicated, at the Royal Rumble. They did the gimmick of where Undertaker subsequently burned in the coffin by Kane. But the historical footnote of greatest interest was at the Royal Rumble, Shawn Michaels taking a horrific bump going out of the ring. When I see it on replay, knowing what happened, I wince every time.
Yeah, but you know what?
His back on the coffin.
At the time, it didn't. There's been worse, but there's been, like, when Mick Foley, for instance, is thrown off the top of a Hell in a Cell and,
right,
you know, finishes the match.
Yeah.
You know, that looks on paper.
But shattering
again,
your vertebrae on a coffin edge.
It was the way. Well, yeah, but.
That's the worst.
It's because you know what happened that I think the makes discs, it hurt a little bit more.
Right.
But when it happened, it was like, okay, he just must have hit it totally wrong. It's one of those things where it didn't. Like, watching it live, you're like, ooh, you know, probably.
Right.
But you're not like, oh, he's gone for 4.5 years. You can kiss your career by Shawn Michaels. You didn't think it at the time.
Right.
But. And it's worth it because Shawn Michaels, look, he was at this point behaving by all accounts like a complete ass backstage. Okay, there were some rumors that he didn't want to do a job for Steve Austin, WrestleMania. And that is disgraceful, okay, if that's true. Okay, I mean, if there was ever a time period where, as you as a champion, have to know it's time to do your job, it was this show. I mean, the Iron Sheik, January 23rd, 1984, you know, is calling Shawn. You got to do the job, man.
Well, and it became a moot point because Shawn knew at a certain point he just couldn't go anyways.
And big thumbs up, though, because he was obviously horribly injured.
He was.
Going into, had no business wrestling.
Right.
Had he not been the world champion putting over Steve Austin that night, no way he
works. I want to diminish his physical sacrifice, but by the same token, this was the era of pilled up Shawn, and that's how he made it through.
Yeah, and also remember, they kept him completely out of the ring. This is the only time this is the only match he wrestled after the Royal Rumble. He was not he was taken off the No Way Out of Texas pay-per-view that month where he couldn't even do an eight-man. An eight-man brawl he couldn't even do.
Right.
They kept him in here, so there's, you know, about 2 months time and then he doesn't wrestle again for 4.5 years. And this is the it's funny that I've been so complimentary on the show because there's no standout match. This is the main event is probably the best match on the show. It's I think like a 4-star match, and maybe that some say that's generous, but it's not a top 20. There's despite the fact there's no top 25 WrestleMania matches on the show.
Right.
I rate this as a top 4 WrestleMania. It was just the pop Austin gets coming out. If there's a bigger pop in wrestling history, I'm not sure I know it.
And with a healthy Shawn Michaels, this could have been a 4.5-star match.
Oh, with a healthy Shawn Michaels, this could have been one of the all-time classics.
Well, by the same token, though, keep in mind, this was post-neck injury for Austin. He was still feeling his way back, and mostly in the brawling kind of a style.
Yeah, well,
that held it back also.
Well, yeah, true, but, you know, I mean, Austin had some great brawl. I mean, 2 months later, Austin had, I thought, the best match of the year in the WWF against Dude Love at Over the Edge, okay?
But he was still feeling his way back at this point. The last thing I want to say about this, it was a point that Bret Hart made. God help me, it seems like I'm always taking issue with something he said, even though he's a 2-time past guest on the show. He's been very gracious to us. But something he said in his book about, Vince didn't have the money to pay me, but he had the money to pay Mike Tyson for this.
That's a selfish comment.
I got to tell you, Bret, money much better spent, because Mike Tyson was the final piece of the engine to launch Stone Cold Steve Austin into the mainstream and light the fuse for the next era.
Yeah, and we need to talk about that. They did the thing with Tyson where he came in and did
endorsed
Austin. Yes. And they were kind of like, we're cool, you know. And again, it's not always about, and you'll love this coming from the, you know, liberal Larry here sitting next to you, okay? It's not about what always is fair in life.
Right.
Again, Owen Hart, was it fair, nice, whatever the term is, that, you know, they kind of held him hostage post Brett, and then, you know, from a storyline perspective, just had him lose to Triple H. Probably it's not fair from his perspective,
right,
but for the overall promotion, it was the right move, just like it was to get rid of Bret Hart and give his money to Mike Tyson for this show, because Bret Hart would not have drawn, and we saw this from the previous 4 years of WrestleManias, would not have drawn 800,000 buys.
Right. Yeah, there's just no way it would have happened. I mean, Austin came in. He was the final piece of the puzzle.
And I thought Michaels was better as the heel to drop to Austin than Bret Hart would have been here.
Well,
I think
it was fresher. It was much fresher.
Yeah, because, you know, Bret and Austin, I know that the, you know, kind of, I guess the urban legend is that it was going to be Bret
doing
the job back to Austin from the previous
year. It would have been full circle from having beaten Austin the 2 times previously in the big matches. It would have been a little bit of full circle, but I like the freshness of Austin Michaels.
So did I. And again, that Attitude Era, I know Michaels was not a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, he was kind of just around for the beginning. I loved the interviews, DX, because I know that they were like, that, you know, he wasn't very complimentary towards anyone else in the promotion, but
right.
I thought he did a very, very good job on the mic building this match, and I don't think Bret Hart would have done as good a job as Shawn Michaels did as, you know, positioning himself as the chief antagonist of the company. Bret kind of always, his heel shtick was that he was right. You know, he kind of, like, Michaels knew what he was doing was,
right.
from a character perspective, was wrong and stuff like that.
And he reveled in it.
Yes, and he was much better as kind of like the prancing around
yeah.
guy, whereas Bret was kind of a man's man.
When you call yourself a degenerate, you're not looking to point out the rightness, the underlying
yeah.
rightness of
yeah.
your actions.
He was just, I thought he was better in this role than Bret would have been. And some people can disagree, but they're wrong.
Now, the one thing is, well, I'll give you this, as we're starting to transition to WrestleMania 15 and moving forward and the tiny bit of macro.
Do you agree that this is
up.
One of the best WrestleManias ever?
I agree. I watched it at the time and I loved it. The only thing was, in looking at this, for Vince McMahon, and I'm just looking at it in a kayfabe perspective, Bret Hart would have been much better for Vince McMahon to buddy up to pre-WrestleMania, because McMahon was basically looking at Shawn Michaels the degenerate as the lesser of two evils. It didn't hurt in the build, mind you, but I look at it from a creative direction. The marriage of Shawn Michaels and Vince McMahon was an odd one, and it's just as well in terms of Shawn's back that it was a short-term one, because Vince McMahon being on the same side of DX just didn't add up.
Well, and they really didn't, though, if you remember.
He didn't insert himself, mind you, but it was they asked him on a Raw. They asked him on a Raw, who are you rooting for? I'm rooting for Shawn Michaels.
Oh, yeah, but that was
planting the seeds?
Yeah, Shawn Michaels, basically, it was kind of a fill in the blank there.
Right.
That was setting up for post-WrestleMania.
Right.
Because remember, Austin was like, oh, you were – it wouldn't have mattered. Steve Austin could have been wrestling Steve Lombardi, you know,
right.
that, and he would have said, "I'm cheering for Steve Lombardi."
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? Like, because Michaels was always very insulting of McMahon the whole
right.
time, building up to it. McMahon, while he was booed, building up to that WrestleMania 14, it was nothing like coming out of that show where he immediately after, and as we moved to WrestleMania 15, positioned himself as the lead heel in the company. Before
right.
he would then, of course, you know, for most of the summer, you know, it was kind of a McMahon-endorsed Mick Foley and then Kane kind of as his henchman.
Right.
You know, where the top feud was clearly Austin McMahon rather than Austin versus a heel wrestler.